It's the All Songs Considered Plus One podcast. Be there.
Makes me laugh every time.
We're going to turn this studio into a mud pit.
Oh, I didn't come dressed for that. Robin Hilton, do you have a song that changed your life?
You asked me this question the other day, and I had to think about it for all of 2 seconds. And here's what it is. Bear with me.
I'm with you. Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this should be your theme song.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it is in many ways. This is the theme, opening theme to Jaws, 1975 movie. Oh, wait. I love this music so much, and there's so many reasons why I would say that this song.
Tell me.
So I was about 7 years old when I first heard this music. I certainly didn't see the movie, but an uncle of mine had this soundtrack on an 8-track tape, and he was playing it in his car. I remember it was a red convertible. Anyway, we were driving down the highway, and he played this for me, and it was the first time that music made me see something in my head. You know. It was very terrifying music, and I could so easily see this story unfolding in my little brain, my little 7-year-old brain, and this music was very much a character in the movie, but it also helped me discover something about myself that's still true to this day, and that is that I usually have my head in the clouds, and it made me realize my own imagination. And I began to hear or see stories in my head with all the music I heard, and it just sort of followed me throughout the day. And then it wasn't long after that. I was still in elementary school when I began to think, I want to do that. I want to make music for movies. I want to marry music with images.
And you do that. You do that with Friends Films, and you do that.
Yeah, I've done a handful of films and podcast themes and... You know, I've done some stuff for NPR, did the election theme and the WOTC theme, and yeah, mostly just for fun, but it's still something that I really, really love.
So I ask you this question about a song that changed your life, because I've been thinking about this for years now, I have a book coming out. It comes out on Tuesday, April 12th. It's called Your Song Changed My Life, and I spent time with 35 musicians talking to them and getting their stories about, like, what is the song that made you wind up doing what you do. And sometimes it was sort of the department of the obvious, but still interesting, which is, you know, someone like Josh Ritter picking a Dylan song. But then sometimes it was like Trey Anastasio, a Fish, picking Leonard Bernstein's song from West Side Story, or Cat Stevens picking Twist and Shout, or St. Vincent picking a Pearl Jam song.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not so far-fetched.
But you actually found when you were doing the book, which I think is really interesting, that most people didn't have an answer right away.
Yeah, it took a while to sort of to figure out, because there'd be so many, mm-hmm. you know, from especially musicians. There'd be so many things that during the course of their life would you know, spark. But the thing that made them want to pick up pen, or the thing that made them want to pick up the guitar, are so many of the stories in my book.
And so we're wondering what everyone out there listening to this podcast thinks. What song changed your life?
Right, you're all music geeks. This is
If you sit down and think about it for a minute, or you may not even have to think about it. You may know right away. There's probably a song that has set you in some direction, on some path in your life. So tell us about it. We have the All Songs Plus One post for this podcast is on our website, npr.org/allsongs. You can leave your story in the comments section on the page, or if you want to get fancy, we have a link for our SoundCloud, and you can go on SoundCloud and record audio of you telling us your story, and we might use it in an upcoming show.
Right. I thought I would do this. The introductory chapter to my book is my story and how a song changed me. I did the audiobook for it, of course. I mean, you could have done it, but that would have been weird. And so I thought I'd just play this little 10-15-minute story about a song that changed me and inspired me and how it did that.
I've just always been fascinated with the butterfly effect. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings and there's this ripple effect that trickles through time. And I love in this opening chapter how you get to the song that you say changed your life. And then you go down this road of all these things that happened. And at the end of the chapter, you come back to, and now we're back to the song that changed my life and how all of this stuff happened because of this one seemingly insignificant moment in my life.
Yeah. Submit your story. We want to know it. For NPR Music, I'm Bob Boylan with Robin Hilton. And here we go. Your song changed my life. It's August 15th, 1965, and a cool summer night as I look toward the glowing lights of Shea Stadium about 10 miles north of me, wishing I was with the Beatles. I'm 12 years old, sitting on my stoop in Queens, New York, holding a Westinghouse transistor radio to my ear. The radio cost me $5 and a label from a bottle of Listerine. It's tuned to WMCA, my favorite AM station. FM barely exists at this point. Less than 2 years ago, on the day after Christmas, WMCA played I Want to Hold Your Hand, becoming the first New York station to play the Beatles. The night of the Shea Stadium show, I struggle to imagine what a concert there would be like. It's the first rock and roll concert to ever be held at a major stadium. Approximately 56,000 people attend, including my next-door neighbor. The show sold out in 17 minutes. Mind you, there's no internet. I read the news the next day and saw the black-and-white footage on TV the following night. The screams drown out the band. The meager sound system, no competition for the level of noise produced by thousands of adoring fans who faint with passion, their hormones raging as they shout the names of their favorites. John, Paul, George, even Ringo. It's a monumental event and one that will eventually pave the way for the sort of arena shows we'll take for granted 50 years later. I loved the Beatles, and if I could turn back the clock to any one night and be someplace, it would be Shea Stadium on that night. My love for the Beatles began alongside America's love for the Beatles. First with their songs on the radio, and then with the newscast of their arrival at the newly renamed John F. Kennedy International Airport, a few miles from my house. President Kennedy was shot 11 weeks before they came to America, and I don't believe it's a stretch to say that our news media was happy to have something to celebrate after so much darkness. On February 9, 1964, 2 out of every 5 Americans turned on their black-and-white televisions to watch the Ed Sullivan Show. The Beatles' appearance had been booked 3 months earlier, at which point no one in America knew them and their songs had never been played on American radio. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to name any British act with a popular song on the U.S. charts then. But by the time they arrived in New York, I Want to Hold Your Hand had shot to number one. Credit their brilliant strategist and manager Brian Epstein, and their sound, of course. I sat in front of the television set with my mom and dad and 13-year-old sister May and thought it was the most thrilling music my 10-year-old ears had ever heard. The Beatles were vibrant and young, none older than 23, and on that night our screens filled with rock and roll, a departure from the normally tame variety show, which often featured Broadway singers, acrobats, comedians, and a magician doing a salt shaker trick. Punk is often credited with shaking up the music world, while we tend to view the British invasion, the wave of British bands that followed in the foot-stomping steps of the Beatles, as cute and adorable. But everything about the music changed after those Brits arrived. Sales of records and record players hit all-time highs, much of the teenage world bought guitars, and your next-door neighbor's garage was as likely to house a budding band as an Oldsmobile. In 1958, guitar sales in the U.S. totaled approximately 300,000. By 1965, barely 1 year into the British invasion, that number had exploded to 1.5 million. The guitar replaced the piano as the main instrument in popular music. My sister and I took lessons, me with the intent to learn all the Beatles songs. I struggled with the instrument, and my teacher later told my mom that I had no musical ability. I was crushed. Instead, I spun 45s endlessly in my bedroom, pretended to be a DJ, created secret make-believe pop charts, and fell deeply in love with music. When I wasn't in school, I always carried two items, my trusty transistor radio and a stickball bat. I lived for baseball and records. At night, I hid my radio under my pillow and listened to either New York Yankees games or rock and roll. My friends were the Zombies, the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, the Animals, the Bo Brummels, the Beach Boys, the Birds, the Yardbirds, and so many others. I bought my first album, Meet the Beatles, at the radio and television repair shop at the local shopping center in Lindenwood, and often walked all the way to the Times Square department store to purchase my 45s. I was raised in a middle-class family in a working-class neighborhood that consisted mostly of Italians and Jews. I was the latter. My dad, Roy Boylan, sold frozen meat and frozen food and the freezers to store them in. My mom, Buzzy, worked the phone, canvassing families and arranging appointments for my dad. He traveled a lot and wasn't home much during the week, but when he was, he listened to big band music. Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, Glenn Miller made him happy. I recall visiting his parents' house and listening to old 78s in the basement. It's a world of music I came to appreciate only much later. My mom loved show tunes and Barbra Streisand music, music that I never came to appreciate. To this day, it drives me up the wall. Though my sister recently reminded me of my obsession as a six-year-old with the Broadway cast album for Flower Drum Song. Sometime around 1965, my dad bought a fancy stereo sound system with a nice Scott FM tube receiver and some snazzy speakers, which I blew up about 5 years later, listening to the deep synthesizer music of Emerson, Lake & Palmer at high volume. The year 1966 saw the evolution of FM radio, and that too changed everything. DJs like Allison Steele, Roscoe, and Scott Muni, among others, started playing what they loved rather than the music they were told to program. For a kid like me, the shift from AM with its low quality and screaming commercials to the low key and high quality sound of FM was mind-blowing. I think it's fair to assert that the development of FM was as revolutionary to the world of music as the one we've seen in the 21st century with the transition from CDs to digital downloads and now online streaming. With the advent of FM, music that catered to particular tastes rather than mass appeal had a home. It was the first time I heard the Velvet Underground. It was the beginning of underground music, later called alternative, later called indie. The thread is long, but the aesthetic is the same. Music as art, not commodity. By 1966, technology made the recording process more expressive and the listening process more trippy. So did the drugs. Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, 1965, and The Doors' Light My Fire, 1967, were short songs on the AM dial, but twice as long and twice as interesting on FM. It was also the year of mind-altering albums, including The Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, The Beatles' Revolver, Bob Dylan's double album Blonde on Blonde, The Mothers of Invention's Freak Out, and The 13th Floor Elevators, the psychedelic sound of The 13th Floor Elevators. Albums began to have concepts. No longer were they simply vehicles for hit songs. In fact, the Beatles released numerous hit singles that didn't even make it onto the UK editions of their albums, such as We Can Work It Out, Day Tripper, Penny Lane, and Strawberry Fields Forever. In the summer of 1967, I went to my friend Alan's house. He'd just returned from the record store and played for me the most mind-boggling, beautiful album I'd ever heard, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. If you're not as old as I am, it's important to note that music had never sounded like this before. Imagine growing up in a city and walking into a forest for the first time. That's what the experience of this album was like for me. We sat and listened to swirling, unidentifiable sounds from India, vaudeville, the circus, the farm, the classical concert hall, all otherworldly and newly created. We stared at the colorful cover art, a collage of people, some real, some fictional, known, unknown. The gatefold opened to a photograph of a band we recognized, but one that was also deeply changed, adorned by beards, mustaches, and bright red, green, pink, and blue, nearly day-glow military uniforms. Best of all, the lyrics were printed on the back cover, something I'd never seen before, so we could follow along word for word. It was an adventure, a journey, and, to steal a term from the day, a trip. For me, the album's closing track, A Day in the Life was the most startling of all. It's a song that changed my life forever. The lyrics are both straight storytelling and impressionism, pedestrian and poetic. It was two completely different songs, sonically melded into one, opening with John Lennon's simple strumming of an acoustic guitar as he tells a tale inspired by two different newspaper articles, one about 4,000 potholes to be repaired on the streets of Blackburn in Lancashire, and the other about the death of Tara Brown, an heir to the Guinness Brewery fortune, in a high-speed car crash. And Lennon sings, "He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords." The lyrics were the result of the important and often disputed collaboration between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Lennon admitted that Paul added the line, "I'd love to turn you on," as a bit of a poke at the stiff upper lip British establishment. And Paul also had a bit of a tune he was working on that didn't have much to it, and that somehow found its way into the song, almost as a counterpoint to the poignant, impressionistic words sung by John. Paul sings, "Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head, found my way downstairs and drank a cup, and looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat, made the bus in seconds flat, found my way upstairs and had a smoke, somebody spoke, and I went into a dream." But it's the orchestral chaos that really takes this song to a whole new level. It's massive. It builds and it builds based on an idea producer George Martin claims Lennon gave him. In All the Songs, the story behind every Beatles release, Martin recounts the moment. "What I'd like to hear is a tremendous build-up from nothing up to something absolutely like the end of the world." Martin hired an orchestra and recorded them multiple times, then mixed it all together, the equivalent of something like 160 musicians. "That day, I left Alan's house floored, bought my own copy, and listened to it every day in whole or parts for years. To this day, I'm astounded at the progression of this band from their first recordings in 1963 to what they accomplished by album number 8, Sgt. Pepper's." There's a monumental difference between a simple song like "I Want to Hold Your Hand" and "A Day in the Life" just 4 years later. Because I witnessed that progression and understand how bands can change and music can morph, I've come to want all music to be like that. It's what keeps me searching for new songs and new artists, and what keeps me excited for an artist's second, third, even 10th album. In 1968, my family moved from Queens, New York to Bethesda, Maryland. It was a cultural shock, to say the least. I'd lived briefly in Poughkeepsie, but really only knew New York City. I was 15, a budding hippie with long, straight hair parted down the middle, but I still loved sports. Back in the late 60s, communication was much slower, so trends weren't as national as they are now. At the time, Bethesda was more a jock culture than a hippie one, and those two worlds didn't play nice. The baseball coach hated my long hair, often gave me a rough time, and never allowed me to pitch a game. I also found it hard to root for the Yankees while living in what felt like a southern town with its drawling accent. I was an oddball with bell-bottom pants, a common fashion back in Queens, but not yet the norm in Maryland. And my accent, well, I never knew I had one till I hit Bethesda, and the kids made fun of it. I receded to my room and my records, found a good local shop, Empire Music, which was within walking distance, and fell in love with Cream, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, Neil Young, Jethro Tull, and later Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Fairport Convention, David Bowie, Roxy Music, and Brian Eno. I turned off the AM radio for good around 1969 and never looked back. In 1971, shortly after I graduated from high school, I started working full-time at a record store, the Rockville, Maryland branch of a DC area chain called Waxy Maxies. The owner was Max Silverman, a cigar-smoking, completely hairless, old-school businessman who received his music education alongside folks like Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records fame. We sold albums for $3.99, 45s for 77 cents, and these newfangled 8-track tapes for about $4.99. I worked 48 hours a week and made about $1.75 an hour. At the time, it was enough to pay my tuition at Montgomery Community College, which was about $300 a semester. I started out as a psychology major, couldn't stand it, and then transferred to the University of Maryland to study business. I attended school in the morning, then worked the 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. shift at the record store. I had Sundays to do my schoolwork. Over the years, I moved from simple record clerk to assistant manager, and then, after I dropped out of college, manager at one of the Waxy Maxy stores. I think of those years as my musical education. I'd listen to records all day, talk about them with my workmates, and the many geeky kids like me who came into the store to get turned on to something unknown, and who would sometimes turn me on to something unknown. In 1975, I saw a photograph by Robert Mapplethorpe in the New York Times of a skinny young woman with a messy, boyish haircut wearing what looked like a man's suit and a skinny tie. The woman's name was Patti Smith, and the photo accompanied an article about Smith's just-released album, Horses. The energy of this record reminded me of the burst of electricity I first felt in 1964 with the Beatles, only this was ballsier, more poetic, with Jim Morrison of the Doors and Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground as touchstones. It felt like things were about to change. The spacey sounds, the art and progressive rock I'd come to love, and the world of the bloated supergroup were about to be strip-searched and ransacked, and this was good. I loved the punk music coming from New York City and the UK. In 1976, I was still working for Waxy Maxy's, now running their warehouse, filling orders from 13 stores. I was also the import buyer for those weird records that might never have made it into the U.S. Nick Drake's Pink Moon and The Clash's self-titled debut are a few of the memorable examples. But all the while, I felt the tug, and groups like Talking Heads, Television, the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks, and the Ramones called to me, forcing me to confront a secret wish I never admitted since those failed guitar lessons as a kid. I wanted to make music. A friend of mine, Jody Bloom, took me downtown to an art space called the WPA, the Washington Project for the Arts. There I met painters, poets, musicians, writers, and photographers, a world of people with their heads buried in creation and expression. At 25, my eyes were open. I started attending shows at DC Space, owned by my now longtime friend Bill Worrell. It was a bar and restaurant with a loft space for music, often curated by Bill, who loved avant-garde jazz and new music in general. I saw John Cale of the Velvet Underground play a poorly tuned piano, saw Anthony Braxton and George Lewis play amazing jazz, and eventually began putting on my own shows there alongside my apartment mate David Howcroft. We would showcase musicians from New York, including James Chance's screeching no-wave jazz band, The Contortions. As for making music, I still hadn't figured out a way to create my own sound. I didn't have the skill or the craft to pick up an instrument loaded with as much cultural expectation as the guitar. I tried twice and realized I'd never be as good as the folks I admired. Sometime around 1978, my friend David and I left the Maryland suburbs and moved to D.C. During our apartment search, we looked at a small building on Wisconsin Avenue and met two young superintendents. I saw a Talking Heads 77 album on the floor beside their record player and knew it was home. We moved in a few weeks later. Around 1978, the DC music scene was a strange mix of blues bands, rock and roll bar bands, and garage bands, some doing covers, some originals, along with a few arty, punky types, and some progressive rock bands. The local radio station, WGTB, supported all these disparate strands of mostly guitar-based rock. On a Friday evening in the early days of 1978, at a restaurant-turned-nighttime hangout, the Atlantis Club, I saw a transformative show by the D.C.-based group The Urban Verbs. Their sound was brash, not punk, urgent, not angry, psychedelic, not retro, and arty without pretense. I loved Roddy Frances' stuttering, singing, and poetry, and their drummer Danny Frankel
was probably the first to ever make my feet move in a nightclub. I'm a more intense listener than a dancer, and the textures created by the two guitarists, Robert Goldstein and Robin Rose, distorted, delayed, sometimes melodic, and somewhat dissonant, hit the pleasure center of my brain. The band's second guitarist eventually bought a synthesizer, adding to the group's mighty sound. I went to see this band a lot over the years, probably more than I'll ever see any other band, and I became friends with the members. One night, after a show, I was speaking with their guitarist, synthesist Robin Rose. He asked me if I'd like to borrow his ARP Odyssey for the weekend. It was a generous, thoughtful offer, and one that changed my life. I took the instrument and was soon enthralled by the soundscapes I could conjure. Unlike the guitar, it felt free of rules. I could create a variety of sounds by repositioning the sliders and the switches. And the keyboard, though traditional with its black and white keys, didn't have to be played like a piano. Each key's sound was determined by the position of the many sliders. The possibilities seemed endless. A few months later, the superintendents of our building, the couple with the Talking Heads album, George and Elizabeth Brady, decided to move and help launch an over-the-air TV subscription service. This is before cable TV hit Washington. And when they asked David and me if we'd like to run the apartment building, we said yes, even though we had no skills or experience. So now I had no rent to pay. I quit my job at Waxy Maxy's and spent the retirement benefits check they sent me on my very own ARP Odyssey. A few months later, I met a brilliant guitarist, Michael Barron, who was in search of a synthesizer player. He already had a singer in mind, Susan Mumford, and along with my friends Joe Menneker and Chris Thompson, we formed Tiny Desk Unit. Before I knew it, I was on stage. My life was completely altered, and my secret dream, sparked by the punk attitude of the time and fueled by the creativity of my heroes, the Beatles in particular, was realized. Tiny Desk Unit was a psychedelic dance band. Our songs were long, meandering, and unexpected musical journeys. I developed my own sound on the ARP, often listening to Michael's guitar harmonics and searching for tones that enriched and intertwined with his. Other times, I was inspired by the voice or the drums and produced sounds that were vocal or percussive. I could barely play a melody on the keyboard, and even all these years later, I'd be hard-pressed to play a simple C chord. I never mastered the basics, never really cared to. I took my limitations, my inabilities, and turned them into advantages, with no fear of doing something wrong. There was no right or wrong, just choices that either satisfied my ears or didn't. The Atlantis Club gave way to a more artist-friendly, dedicated venue in the same space, the 930 Club, at 930 F Street, Northwest, in Washington. On May 30th, 1980, Tiny Desk Unit became the first band to play the 930 Club, and soon became the other well-loved local art rock band next to the Urban Verbs, selling out most of our shows. We started a record label with newfound friends and released a live album, recorded at the 930 Club, to capture the adrenaline of our live performances. We later made a studio EP, Naples, and then, with the aid of alcohol, heroin, and other street drugs, we self-destructed. I became friends with Nick Koumoutsias, the engineer and owner of the studio where we recorded our EP. One day, he handed me the studio keys and told me I could come in and learn the gear when no one was around. He didn't teach me about the equipment. Perhaps he thought it was best for me to figure it out on my own. He had a digital synthesizer called the Synclavier 2, and it wasn't long before I was deep into the mighty world of digital sound creation. Shortly after the demise of Tiny Desk Unit, my friend Kirby Malone asked me to compose the music for his newly formed multimedia theater collective, Impossible Theater. I had 6 weeks to compose songs for something like 25 scenes. I'd never actually written music on my own. I said yes, and to this day, it's some of the best music I ever created. A few years after that, I wrote another piece for one of their art installations. It imagined the history of sound from the beginning of time to the end. We called it Whiz Bang, A History of Sound, and presented it at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. My music sampled everything from bees to sewing machines for rhythms, drones, and melody, and it was one of the earliest pieces to use the then-new, now-ubiquitous technology called sampling. When NPR heard about the piece, they invited me on All Things Considered. Ira Glass, a young show producer at the time, called me in to interview with host Susan Stamberg. I hadn't slept for 36 hours and had spent the past week in front of the new digital sampler, learning how it worked as I composed the music for our Sound and Slide installation. I had a deep love and respect for NPR even then. At first, I said I couldn't do it. My thinking? I was exhausted and had spent the past 6 days with a manual on my lap, my hand pressed against my jaw like Rodin's The Thinker, and because of the constant pressure, I could barely open my mouth. I later agreed. I didn't want to pass up a chance to be on NPR and to have this work heard by a larger audience. The interview went well, and for the first time, I heard my voice on the radio. Back then, in 1983, I was also working at a TV station, the same one my former superintendents had run off to start. It later became a regular UHF station with some nice production equipment, which I taught myself to use during non-work hours. I then became a producer for their station, even though I didn't much care for TV. I had been in love with radio ever since I was that little kid with my transistor tucked under my pillow. 5 years later, I quit my job, walked to NPR, and found that young producer, Ira Glass. I told him I wanted to work there. He asked if I cut tape. I said, yes, though honestly, I barely knew what he was talking about. I'd never cut an interview before. He gave me a reel, a razor blade, a grease pencil, and some splicing tape, told me to cut the interview down from 20 minutes to 4, and said that it had to flow naturally, like a conversation. So that's what I did, and I guess I did pretty well. After that, I showed up at All Things Considered every morning and asked if they needed help. They gave me temp work, and I began cutting tape regularly for the show. They'd hire me for a week, then two, and within the year, I was directing the show. To this day, I still find it hard to fathom. I believe that in life, certain people see things in us that we don't see in ourselves. When Nick Camutsius gave me the keys to his studio, I believe he recognized my passion for music and technology and was confident I could figure out the equipment. When the producers of All Things Considered asked me to direct their evening news program, I believe they saw in me, a college dropout without a day's experience in journalism or radio, some sort of proclivity and talent. I will be forever grateful to those who saw something special in me. A Day in the Life tells two main stories, one of a man in his prime whose life ends abruptly in tragedy, the other a tale of the mundane, the everyday, of waking up, running late, and then falling into a dream. For me, these tales sum up life's preciousness and magic. The song inspired me to seize opportunities, to take chances, because we only get one shot at life. In this book, you will hear 35 artists relate one basic story. It's a story of what motivates us, drives us towards this invisible and mysterious art we call music. It's a story of how a song can be a call to action, to pick up an instrument or a pen, to find your voice, to spill your soul, and change your life, and perhaps someone else's.